This is the GamesIndustry.biz microcast for Monday, 25th of March, 2024. I'm James Batchelor, Editor-in-Chief of GamesIndustry.biz, and joining me back from San Francisco is Head of GamesIndustry.biz, Christopher Dring. Hello, sir. How are you and how's the jet lag?
I've got a very young child, as you know, James, who doesn't sleep through the night.
Yes.
So I may or may not be jet lagged. I just know I'm tired.
Yeah.
there's
You have what I started after I became a dad. You have what I refer to as parent lag, which is where, regardless of which side of the Atlantic Ocean you wake up on, you are waking up at 3 a.m. and it is just normal.
That was the tragedy, actually, of GDC for me. Finally, nights where I could uninterrupted sleep, and I probably got averaged about 3 to 4 hours a night.
I remember my first GDC after my son was born, going out there thinking, yes, I get to sleep. I'm so sorry for my wife because she has got to deal with this on my room, but I get to sleep. And I was still awake at three. The difference was, prior to parenthood, you're tired enough that you fall asleep again, but I was so used to it, I was just awake. All right.
Where's my 3DS? I went to the gym. This is the new Gamer Parent podcast brought to you.
Absolutely, because there aren't enough of those out there. There aren't enough Gamer Parent podcasts. No, we are going to be digging into the biggest stories of the past week. Although there aren't any specific stories, there's one or two that we're going to touch on. But I kind of wanted to use this opportunity, like post GDC, Chris, you were out there at San Francisco all week. Get your sense of like a, kind of the vibe, what's going on out there, what the conversations are. There weren't as many headlines out of GDC this year. There's usually like, I mean, you know, it's not like, you know, Stadia was announced or first, you know, specs of a new console like used to happen like the PS3 generation. There wasn't any major news as such, but I think there were a lot of interesting conversations from what you've been telling me that around GDC and what people are saying. So, I kind of talk us through it. What was GDC like? The mood?
Well, it was interesting because I heard from DICE. DICE was explicit. I wasn't there, but it was quite bleak. GDC didn't feel, at least, I mean, I didn't speak to all the thousands of people at GDC. I spoke to probably about 150 people. The mood wasn't bleak. It wasn't, to be clear, upbeat either. It was the people who faced the challenges. And of course, it's noting that people who are at GDC are people who could afford to go to GDC. It's not a cheap event to attend.
Mm.
But I got an event I got vibes, you know, everyone was saying it's challenged, it was tough. I met one developer on the flight home who brought over 6 prototypes of games. And they were telling me they had enough financial runway to last the next couple of years. And they went around and they pitched games to some really big companies. And I sort of listened to them. And a lot of the feedback they were getting is that we're not investing now, but we will be soon. They got vibes on some companies were looking to sign stuff now. And the deals aren't as good as they used to be, but they're not as bad as some people feared. It was an interesting series. The conversations I had, there was a couple of negative conversations. But broadly speaking, there was a lot of people that felt that, you know, it felt for me a lot more optimistic than I was expecting. I was expecting a lot of misery, and what I got was a lot of hope, but in difficult times. There was obviously a lot of sort of, you know, we saw the GD scream, and you saw the, and I was at the GDC Awards, and I saw, and there was lots of people making speeches. I thought Larian's speech is the one that was probably the most spot on. Some of the other ones came across as a little naive. I understood the meaning behind what they were saying, but there was a lot of sort of, you know, big statements that people were making about the state of the business. But it felt, I don't know, I actually felt a little bit more optimistic about video games coming out of GDC than did going into it, which wasn't what I was expecting at all. There were a few, you know, overheard at GDC moments that I was like, oh, could I spin this up as an article? And one of them was about the leaked specs around the PlayStation 5 Pro.
Yes.
I'll be honest, I didn't meet a single person that understood the point of it. there was obviously PlayStation 5 fans, they will upgrade, right? And they understood that. It benefits Sony. Developers didn't really seem to feel they needed it, at least the ones I spoke to. They didn't seem to think. I think Rob said the same thing in his column. We weren't really making the most of the PS5 in the first place. A couple of companies said this isn't going to grow the market, this isn't going to move the needle. It'll be there, it'll do something, it'll be a headline somewhere, but this generation doesn't even seem to have got started, really, let alone feel the need to have a mid-generation update. How about we just get some original next-generation software up and spinning? So there was a bit of that. I don't know what the vibe was online around the PS5 Pro, but that's what it was on the ground at GDC.
So it was a bit of a mix, like the... I'll be honest, like the PS5 Pro spec leaks like wasn't as big as I thought it was. At least it kind of didn't flag up on my radar until Rob Fahy, our contributing editor, said, "Hey, I'd like to write a piece on the leaked Pro specs." Like, oh, okay, yeah, absolutely. So I didn't see as much kind of fuss around it. The looking at the actual specs, so Eurogamer/Digital Foundry actually reported on them. The specs are, I'm going to read numbers now. The memory is 576 gigabytes per second, up 28% from the standard PS5's 448 gigabytes per second. The CPU is a 3.85 gigahertz CPU, up 10%. The GPU is capable of 33.5 teraflops, although Eurogamer notes that's not a, you can't do a direct comparison because the PS5 had, the original PS5 had 10.28 teraflops, but it used a different architecture. So the estimated increase is around 45%. So it's not insignificant, I guess. There's new features like the PlayStation Spectral Super Resolution upscaling, more anti-aliasing tech, custom machine learning architecture, AI accelerator, there are bits and words. But like that's the professional opinion. But Rob's point was really interesting because like regardless of what the specs are, the market need is very different from when the PS4 Pro came out. So Rob's column is up on the site. I do recommend people give it a read. When the PS4 Pro came out, 4K TVs, TVs capable of 4K had been coming out, and they'd come out and the adoption had really taken off since the PS4 had launched. So you have got a console that's not capable of producing graphics that make take advantage of the latest TVs. Enough people had bought 4K TVs that a PS4 Pro made sense, and those people who had bought those TVs upgraded to PS4 Pro. Rob estimates, I can't remember where he got this from, but Rob estimates that actually only 15% of the PS4s sold in total over its life cycle were PS4 Pros. So it's a niche. It's an, not a terrible niche, but it's a niche. I can't imagine PS5 Pro being more than that. As you say, it's weird to think we're mid-generation already because it was such a slow start and it stumbled with supply issues and so forth. Like, is the PS5 still tracking behind PS4 at this stage of its life cycle?
Well, it caught up and then it fell behind again.
Right, yeah. So you're right. You're absolutely right. Like, there will be an audience. Rob confessed, he's going to buy this at some point. There's an audience
I'm
for it.
I'm hoping that finally I don't have to choose between performance mode and fidelity mode. That's I think at the moment I got the PS5 and it said you can choose 60 frames per second or 120 frames per second or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Or super high-end ray tracing. And I'm like, I bought a new console. I have to choose which one I want.
Yeah.
This is going to give me everything and more. I like the fact the promise might be delivered.
That was the main reaction online. Like, you were asking the main reaction I saw online was to Rob's piece, obviously. Rob's piece was like, what the hell's the elevator pitch for PS5 Pro? It's going to be a really hard sell because it's not the same status as the PS4 Pro. It's not as significant an upgrade, but it will probably be even more expensive. And the amount of people that replied to these posters and stuff about the article were basically like, yeah, but it's about the performance mode. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to having better performance. Like, so... Yeah, it's that. That seems to be the key sell. But how many people...
I think Sony know that. Like Sony know the PS5 Pro is selling to PS5 users. Let's just have, I'm sure the Switch OLED is primarily selling to existing Switch owners. It's the game. It's the game that's being played. And and I think that's probably fine. It's just not... From a market perspective, it's not a big game changer. It's not something the industry needs at this point. But maybe Sony does.
Mm. Maybe. I mean, obviously we've got... So the PS5 Pro is expected this year. We expected an Xbox Series XS mid-gen refresh this year. So there'll be some new hardware in the market. New hardware usually gives a bit of a boost, but...
Well, it's interesting with Xbox, because that's the other thing I heard. I heard it from a very prominent company, and one not so prominent, Xbox's performance in Europe is just flatlining. And you can follow our monthly coverage in the games market, you can see that Xbox sales are falling, and it's been falling, fell all throughout last year, and it's falling even harder this year. The phrase one major company who released a big game last year said, "I don't know why we bothered supporting it."
Wow.
And it's an issue. We mentioned on the previous podcast, we'd heard that retailers in Europe were considering had already been cutting back their Xbox stock on their shelves and whether that, hardware games, that kind of thing. And now you've got publishers, third-party publishers going, you know, this is we're putting a lot of effort trying to create a Series S version and an X version of a game, when to be honest with you, for us the market is PC and PS5.
Yeah.
And with Xbox putting some of the games on PS5, from what I understand, the majority of them will be coming across at some point, assuming, you know, it progresses as Xbox believes it probably will. I think Xbox is in real trouble as a hardware manufacturer. Mm. And that was the thing that came out of GDC for me. Because I've always been the belief, oh, it's the Game Pass delivery system. It's good. It's got a good UI. It's got a good controller. It's, you know, it's if you like Xbox games, it's probably the best way to play them, etc. I thought it would be fine. But then I didn't really factor in that some developers and publishers might just go, yeah, I don't, you know, is there any point? And that is when you can lose it. And they're talking about releasing more powerful hardware and next generations of devices, but they need to make sure that that it makes sense for studios to continue to make versions of their games for that system. I know they'll be on PC architecture. It's probably not too much work, but it's that was the other thing I kept hearing out of GDC was, what the hell is going on with Xbox? Because, of course, from an Xbox perspective, it's all about, you know, growing the market through its through other platforms and services and stuff like that. It isn't all about their box under the TV. In fact, the box under the TV is probably a very small part of their business. Well, it is a very small part of their business. But from their partner perspective, it's a key element of their business. And yeah. I'll be interested to hopefully speak with Xbox at some point and see what their plan is and what can be done to try and shore that up a bit.
That'd be a really interesting conversation to have. I mean, kind of backing up what you've been hearing at GDC, like I had a press release over the weekend from an indie studio essentially like apologising to the Xbox community for not producing. Essentially, this game came out and they mentioned it might be on Xbox, and apparently this game has just come out and it's not on Xbox, and they said, well, we couldn't do it. We couldn't, like it's all a cost, isn't it? Like, particularly for smaller studios, like, it's a cost, you know, creating a whole other version for a whole other platform, even if that platform is similar to PC or similar, you know, similar architecture. It still costs and time and energy that goes into that poor. And if you're not convinced you're going to get the return on that, then yeah, as you said, like, they're going to focus on PC, PS5. Some studios, particularly indies, might even focus on Switch before Xbox, because like, the audience is so small. The audience for Xbox is so small compared to PlayStation and even Nintendo. Like, it's going to be really intriguing to see what Xbox does, because as you say, like, they're talking about, they're already dropping hints about their next gen console, but you need this one to still have a decent audience.
I mean, I know it's not their priority, but obviously they are transitioning as a business away from one business to another, and that transition, you know, you don't want to kill off your old business too quickly in favour of the new one. I'm sure they've got a plan. It's Xbox, you know, they've got a lot of staff, a lot of talented developers. But it's interesting. I was watching Michael Pachter's podcast, and he was talking about how it's all about Game Pass for Xbox. Mm. Yeah, I actually was hearing that that Microsoft's putting a little bit less focus on Game Pass. So who knows? I think they'll tell you it's a bit of everything, it probably is. So there's a lot of that. I actually felt the news was around GDC was quite positive. Like, I know that I know not a lot of it was GDC necessarily, but the amount of stories we ran in the last 2 weeks about new funding, yep, new studios opening. Like, after, you know, I did a little roundup for the company email, and that was only on Saturday before GDC, and I got up to 12 stories in a week. And I was like, well, I mean, to be fair, that wasn't unusual 2 years ago, but like, in this current climate, that's frankly unheard of. And it was, I mean, you do get a few of these stories around GDC, but I was quite happy to see GDC Games Industry Top has not been quite the depressing read it had been. Like, there was a few sad stories in there, but overall
there was another four layoff stories last week. But then, like, as you said, like, yeah, like 12, not that it's a numbers game, but like, you know, having more new studio stories than layoff stories has got to be kind of a shift towards the positive. And like, and I always kind of take, like, you know, the number of new studios we see, there's going to be even more new studios out there that we don't know about. Like, the ones we see, the ones like, you know, former AAA devs that have started, you know, like the Stig Asmussen started Giant Skull and you spoke to him. We saw Bullet Farm is a new AAA studio from NetEase, led by David Vonderhaar. I've got an interview with him going up this week. Like, so there's some big talent starting new teams. But for all of those, there's untried and untested talent that are probably starting up very quietly or in stealth, and we won't find about them until a year, 2 years hence. Like, it's it's really encouraging that, yeah, new things are starting up. There was a story on our site. There was a study saw that the number of UK game startups in the UK, just specifically in the UK, the number of UK game startups is up 22% year on year, partly due to layoffs, like, you know, the number of people who have been laid off and banded together to form a studio. But the fact that they've been able to secure, like, the funding and so forth to establish a company is brilliant. Like,
there is money out there.
Yeah.
There are publishers trying to sign games. There's just a lot less. Mm. And that was another conversation I had with somebody, an analyst, I wouldn't call him somebody senior in the industry, who believes, and we actually had this in one of our analyst pieces. It was mentioned by, I think, at London Venture Partners. And it's something that I've also speculated as well, in that every games company's cutting the amount of projects they're working on, whether it's the amount of games they're developing or the amount of games they're signing, they're all cutting it. There's a suggestion that there was too many projects in the works. There's too many big games being developed in this industry. There wasn't a market to sustain them all. But the thing is, when everybody's cutting the number of projects, we might end up in a situation in a year, maybe even less, maybe 2 years, where actually we don't have enough projects on the go, and we'll have to correct our correction. And yeah. it's hopefully nothing quite so as substantial as we've seen in it won't be anything as substantial as we've seen in the recent history, but. It may be that that perhaps we have cut too deeply. It's difficult to know. A lot of the stuff that we're talking about in the market, a lot of the challenges we talk about in the market around the lack of time people have and money and the challenges in that area, the games industry always has these issues. The games industry always has problems. You can go back to when it used to be pre-owned or whatever. Like, there's always been issues in the games industry that it's had to overcome. It's just that we've not normally had quite such intense macroeconomic conditions over the top, which kind of puts more of a focus on it. And I'm hoping that that a lot of the stuff that we're talking about being big issues in the games industry perhaps aren't as big as they might seem. They just seem big, considering the wider circumstances that we're in as an industry. We will find out. I came out of GDC feeling better about the games industry than I did going into it, I can't really put my finger on it. It felt a little quieter, but I don't know why I'd think that. Every hotel lobby was bustling. I only went to a few of the talks. They're all packed out. The ones I went to. Mm. I mean, admittedly, they were the Nintendo ones, but it didn't seem. On the one hand, it felt quieter, but on the other hand, it was clearly very still very vibrant and lots of things going.
It certainly seemed busy from, like, you know, from the other side of the ocean. Like, I was getting proper FOMO because, like, you know, the amount of, like, conversations you're seeing about GDC online, the amount of you know, photos you're seeing of people meeting up and so forth. Like, it didn't look quiet. It didn't look like a kind of a non-event. So
Big companies out there. Nintendo were out there in force. Microsoft was out there in force. PlayStation was out there. They're all out there meeting developers. I was on a table at GDC next to Shuhei Shida. We all went to an Xbox indie mixer, and there was Trish Charla and Sarah Bond and Phil Spencer. You know, Nintendo were out there meeting with developers, going not just to the event, not just on their own booth. They were going to all the little events around the side, meeting people, trying to find developers. There was just the big platform holders, obviously. There was a lot of activity going on, people trying to meet developers, find games, publish games, fund games. The market's difficult, but it's not, you know, there's money out there, and people want games.
I wonder, I'm intrigued, going back to something we were saying earlier, I'd be intrigued to know whether this was kind of a make or break GDC for a number of studios, because, like, there is money out there, but as you say, and as you've covered before, like, the bar for success in terms of securing that investment is a much higher. Like, we ran a piece with Kyokin Interactive week before GDC. Kyokin Interactive are the ones who do Deliver Us Mars, Deliver Us the Moon, like, kind of these narrative sci-fi adventures. And they basically said, like, you know, 200 pitches to, and, you know, this is not typical of all studios, obviously this is their experience, but they made 200 pitches across 2 years for five games, and they got no, you know, sometimes the conversation proceeded, but they didn't land the funding. So they kind of did this kind of public call for, can you help raise awareness, you know, calling out to their community, can you help spread awareness that we're looking for funding, we're heading to GDC, etc. Now, they were quite vocal about it. I wonder how many other studios were in a similar position where it's like, we need funding this GDC, we need this GDC to land a deal, otherwise we're going to be in trouble. Like, I don't want to take away from the cautious optimism you're showing, obviously.
I'm actually wary of, because I didn't meet any. I, I'm almost certain there was a lot of desperate developers out there that saw this as their last shot. I didn't meet them. So I'm sort of talking about the small group of people that I met and I was at the event I was at and I chatted to, who, you know, they weren't like, yeah, it's easy, it's great. They believed they could get something. And it was, and I met those. And I think it's worth noting there were thousands of people there that I met, that I didn't speak to. And I don't want to bait for a second that, my experience is somehow indicative of everybody else's. It's just whenever I spoke to other people and I said, I get the impression the mood seemed to be a bit not as bad as I expected it to be.
Mm.
And most people I spoke to agreed with me, but then maybe they spoke to the same people I did. I don't know. But I suspect there was some desperation. One of the only thing that I noticed several times, I kept looking at people's badges to see where they were from and I thought, oh, that studio doesn't exist anymore. I sat in front of someone from Deviation Games, for instance, and it's like there were a lot of people who still managed to go to GDC, because they'd obviously sorted out their passes beforehand at a company they were at, and they're not there, but yes, and there were some companies I spoke to who were hiring, it's not quite as free for all as it was, a few years ago. You can feel when you read the stories online, you can spend all your time in social media, it can feel like the whole industry's shut down. There's no money, there's no jobs, and it isn't that extreme. It is obviously very, very difficult.
Mm. Yeah, that's particularly on social media. Social media can be a kind of a real echo chamber for the negative aspects, and that's not to deny that the negative aspects are there. But they can kind of drown out.
They can make the negative seem
massively. Yeah. Absolutely. One other thing I wanted to ask you about GDC was your take on like the presence of AI, because
I should have called it a GDC AI or AI. I don't know, the AI Developers Conference. It was everywhere. It was when I last went, it was all blockchain.
This is the thing.
That seemed to have gone.
Brendan's joked about this before, like in two consecutive years of This Week in Business, like his GDC issue is basically like GDC is the place to go where like you get a sense of what the next big thing that people are touting, and it's usually like it was VR 1 year, then it's blockchain, it's Web3, it's metaverse, like it's whatever the buzzword is, but it's AI again this year. Marie was saying in our team Slack that all the Web3 companies have been replaced by AI companies.
I guess that's the one thing I haven't spoken about is I played the Ubisoft Neo.
So that's NPC. What I wanted to ask about, because you played the Neo NPCs demo. Like you played it then, did you?
Yes, well, I thought I went to their event on Monday. I ditched our own party. This is absolutely true. GI threw a party on the Monday night. I was hosting a quiz. I left at the beginning of the party to go to Ubisoft's event, play their new NPCs, and I came back and did a quiz. Hosted a quiz. Yes, I did. And you know what? There's something there, right?
Yeah.
And this is the thing, I actually talked to Chris Tapsall at Eurogamer, who I was with at the time, I went to the event with. And he also agreed, he doesn't want to completely condemn it because there was something there. And it's weird, my thing was that there was a moment that opens up, the first demo is there's an NPC called, is it Bloom? I think his name's Bloom. And you're supposed to befriend him. You're supposed to ask him a series of questions in order to get tick boxes and you level up your character relationship with them. Now, here's the thing, all of these characters are written characters, as in their backstory, who they are, what they're trying to do, what their motivations are, set by writers, by a creative team. And then you can ask them any question and then they'll deviate off and they'll go off something. But they've been constrained in by the writers. And certain bits have even been scripted if you say the right things, right? So it's just that you can ask. First thing I asked him, he was wearing a slightly garish shirt. I asked him about his shirt, right? Like, it probably wasn't in the script. He gave an answer about his shirt. Was the writing brilliant? No. It felt a little bit interesting to me. I read one article where somebody says, who's going to sit in their room talking to their TV? And I'm like, was it any different to just talking online with your friends? Like, for me, it was, if you're worried about how it looks, like, it doesn't look any different, does it? My thing with that is I started talking to, he's a guy, he's part of a resistance group that you're part of, you're supposed to befriend him, and the idea is that you're going to do a mission. Like, it's all very vague. And in it, he told me he got his shirt from a thrift shop down the street. and I just couldn't stop going on about his shirt, right? And he's been a very patient NPC the whole time. And eventually we ended up basically started to concoct a mission to investigate the thrift shop down the street. And I sort of enjoyed that. I thought a hat was quite funny and quite fun. And then the other two I struggled to get to work quite so well, because one was like, if something was going on in gameplay and I'd ask a question, he wouldn't answer the question because he's in the middle of gameplay. And I guess that's the point. The point is the game would let you, you know, have fun with it, but still ultimately you're playing a game. And it kept bringing you back to the game. When I had to do a strategy, the third one was like, go, you know, you're being invested, like a Rainbow Six style, how are you going to break into this building type experience? And I said, and she clearly, the late Ian or someone who was the woman who was the strategist with me, was sitting there going, right, I want you to, you know, how are we going to break into this building? I went, let's go to the pub, was my response to it. So that would help us relax and plan the mission, but let's focus. But, so she kept bringing me back to the mission. I thought it was quite interesting because I thought to myself, well, this is still a scripted, not completely scripted, but it's still an experience, story driven experience. I don't know about you, James, I know you're a creative writer. When I did creative writing courses, I was always told to let the characters lead the way, right? And there's an element of, you choose the characters' backstories and who they are and their personalities, and you know what beats you need to hit in a storyline, but then maybe in between the characters will take you on that adventure. And here's the thing, this is what this sort of was sort of showing me what it could do. I don't think we're that far away from it actually being quite effective. And I think Ubisoft are very key that this is about, you know, this isn't possible without the creatives in the first place. You couldn't just do this with AI. I thought there was something there. It wasn't like, if someone gave me this as a game, I wouldn't give it a great review. But it was a tech demo they knocked up in a month. And I just was a bit like, you know, this is, there's something to this that might be interesting in a different, you know, with smarter creative people than me. Some people compared it to Peter Molyneux's Milo.
For good or bad. Yeah.
But I thought there was something there. I interviewed, so two people at Ubisoft, and it will be going up on GI at some point in the imminent future, about, you know, their thinking around all this and where it's going. I did see there was a lot of AI though, and a lot of it was, I still think a lot of it was just, you know, chances. Like I walked into several hotels with people with laptops open with the name of their company written in Times New Roman, just going, I'm from Nuvo AI, I'm from, you know, Renegade AI, and it's like, they thought, yeah, so your booth is this table in this hotel half a mile from the convention center. It there's a lot of that going on. But in terms of what I played of Ubisoft stuff, I thought it was I'm not going to say it was good, but it was interesting, and I think there might be something there.
That does intrigue me. I'm interested. Like, because a lot of players, myself included, like, really get into, certainly like RPGs and stuff, like the relationship between player character and like the companion style character. And if you're able to actually have that relationship by verbally speaking to them and choosing, rather than choosing from like a drop down list of lines to, you know, pick up lines to use,
it's
like actually.
Shows how poor my imagination is, but I imagine, you know, those sort of slightly awkward conversations you're having when you're walking with an AI character and you're going somewhere, and it's like, oh, you know, and there's sort of some weird stilted dialogue. When you actually be, you can ask them if they fought a Doctor Who last night or something. Like, you know, it could be, you could sort of maybe do that. The key thing Ubisoft were talking about was the fact that at the moment it requires a connection to the internet. And in order for it to work, and they said that's not great for so many different reasons, including environmental reasons, and so they need to be able, you need to be able to create these AIs using locally. That's their next challenge need to unlock. But they think they will unlock it.
That is that a software thing or is that a hardware thing? Is that going to be, you know, the next generation consoles? Are they going to need kind of those AI accelerators and
proof
stuff?
We need a PS5 Pro.
Nice, absolutely. I think that's probably a good note to wrap up on. It sounds like you had a great week. Like, is there anything else you kind of want to get off your chest or anything about GDC? It sounds like you've shared all the goss you've got. So
I'm very tired.
You're very tired.
It's a strange show. Professionally, I enjoyed it. I'm not entirely sure I enjoyed it personally. It was just very tiring, and I haven't been for a little while. I haven't since before the pandemic actually. And it hasn't changed a great deal.
Right. Well, welcome home. Best of luck staying awake for the rest of the day. Thank you, dear listener or viewer, for joining us. If you're watching, you're watching on the GamesIndustry.biz YouTube channel. If you're not watching, then that's where you find it. You can find all previous episodes of the MarketCast on the podcasting platform of your choice. And you can find more news, insight and analysis in the world behind video games at GamesIndustry.biz. We're going to be back next Tuesday because Monday is Easter Monday, so half the team is off. So we will see you in just over a week. Thank you very much for joining us.